Welcome to the Institute of Catholic Culture. We are a non-profit Catholic organization dedicated to the re-evangelization of our society through educational and cultural programs offered to the public at no charge. This presentation and many others are available through our online library at instituteofcatholicculture.org and on our ICC app. Please view our upcoming schedule of live online events and engage with us on social media. For handouts, links, and further study materials, please visit this program's page on our website or app.
Our speaker this evening is a professor of English at the Franciscan University of Steubenville after 9 years at Christendom College, where he served as English department faculty, director of the Advanced Studies Program, and academic dean. Dr. Ben Reinhardt's research focuses on Anglo-Saxon literature and culture, Middle English literature, and the Inklings. Ben received his BA from Purdue University and his MMS and PhD from the University of Notre Dame. His most recent book is The High Hallow, Tolkien's Liturgical Imagination, from Emmaus Road Publishing. Ben is originally from Bluffton, Indiana, and currently lives in Steubenville with his wife, Hannah, and their 5 children. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Ben Reinhardt. Dr. Reinhardt, it's all yours.
Thank you very much. So I think it's customary to begin with prayer. So let's begin. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Thank you very much for the introduction. That was very kind and very gracious. And it's a great pleasure tonight to be talking to the ICC about Geoffrey Chaucer and the Canterbury Tales. So my goals tonight are going to be pretty simple. This is the first of a 3-part lecture series, so the most important thing is understanding a little bit about who Chaucer is and the world he inhabits. The general prologue offers you a frame for the whole of the Canterbury Tales, so we're going to be looking at that in some detail. And if we can get through the 2,000-plus line Knight's Tale, I'll feel really, really good about our progress tonight, because that will give us an orientation about how we should read the other tales that we'll be approaching in the next few weeks. This is going to be a challenge. I just got done teaching a semester-long course on Chaucer, where we did things like spend 100 minutes of class time on the general prologue and, you know, a week on the Knight's Tale. So it's going to be a little bit of a challenge to do all this in the next 50 minutes here, but we'll do what we can. There was some conversation about translations, recordings. Neville Coghill, who was a friend of Lewis and Tolkien, has a recording of the general prologue all up for free on archive.org. So you can get the old Coghill recording, which gives you a great sense of how this should sound. And that can help you with the Middle English if you feel so inclined. But for right now, let's dive in. Geoffrey Chaucer, the father of English poetry, is our subject for the next 3 class periods. Now, father of English poetry is a bit of a problem as a term. We were talking about Professor Tolkien before class. Tolkien hated the term. He'd point out that there were a solid 800 years of poetry in English in England before Chaucer was born. Chaucer is further removed from the birth of English poetry, Tolkien would say, than we are from him, which is a little bit of a sobering thought. Tolkien would point out, you've got Beowulf, you've got the Dream of the Rood, you've got the Wanderer, you've got the Seafarer, you've got all this body of poetry before Chaucer, centuries before. How can he be the father of anything? With respect to Tolkien, Chaucer may not be the origin of all English poetry, but he really is the father of our English poetry. He starts off a tradition of English poetry that's continued down for the past 600 years, that continues today in a way that no one else ever had before him. Even if we look at his great contemporaries, people like John Gower or William Langland or the Pearl Poet, these people wrote great poems in the 1370s and 1380s, but they didn't start a tradition. In the case of the Pearl Poet, who's at least as good as Chaucer, he's from a sort of backcountry dialect area. Nobody can read him. Langland's a little too serious, but Chaucer starts something new, and he has successors and imitators in the 1400s, the 1500s. Shakespeare reads Chaucer. Milton reads Chaucer. Everyone reads Chaucer. And still today, anyone who does poetry in English belongs to this great tradition. The exciting thing about Chaucer is he's not just an exemplary poet. He's also an exemplary instance of the Catholic imagination. I apologize. Franciscan University's air conditioning is not working tonight. So if you see me perspiring, that's chalked up to antiquated ACs. So here we go. Mercy. Well, so let's dive into the world of Chaucer. Let's dive into his background. There are two things that you get struck by when you understand the world that Chaucer comes from. The first thing that you'll see is just how far Chaucer's removed from our contemporary picture of a poet. We sort of think of poets as these retiring figures sitting with a quill pen by the fireside. Chaucer may have done that. He's also very much a man of the world. And the world that he lives in is absolutely insane. This is the second thing. He is born around 1340. He dies right around the year 1400. These are some of the most tumultuous years of English history, which affect a whole-scale transformation of English life. And let's talk about that now. Chaucer is born early 1340s to John and Agnes Chaucer, who are London vintners, that is to say, makers and sellers of wine. He's a thoroughly middle-class boy from no particularly connected world. We don't know where he was educated. We don't know much about his first 15 years or so. There are no records. He must have received some education somewhere. We just don't know where. He first pops up in the historical record in the year 1357, when he is a page in the household of Elizabeth de Burgh, who's the Countess of Ulster. All right? What this shows you already is that Chaucer and his family are sort of upwardly mobile. They're men on the move, to move from London vintners to a countess's house and become part of her retinue. A couple of years later, he goes with Prince Lionel on campaign in the Hundred Years' War. He gets himself captured and ransomed pretty promptly afterwards because apparently somebody saw his value. The 1360s are him coming into his own sort of as a man, as an independent person. His father dies in 1366, which means he is now fully his own man. He gets married to Philippa, who's a lady-in-waiting to the queen. 1367, he becomes formally a member of the royal household. Now, this is part of the counteracting the image of the poet thing. As a member of the royal household, he's not noble. He's not knighted. None of this stuff. He's called an esquire or a valet. And his job is to sort of hang around the royal household and be generally useful. He's kind of a gopher or a diplomat or a fix-it man, and he gets employed on all sorts of interesting and occasionally top-secret missions for the English crown over the next 15 years. In the early 1370s, he goes to Italy, goes to Florence. He may have met Petrarch and Boccaccio, leading figures of the Italian Renaissance, who were still alive at that time. He comes back and becomes really firmly entrenched with the royal family. A fun anecdote, not deeply important, but fun, is in 1374, King Edward III grants Chaucer a perpetual annuity of a gallon of wine per day for life. He's done some service to deserve a gallon of wine a day. Now, Chaucer eventually just cashes this in for the cash value of it, but he's become dear to the king in this way. He gets a little house on a gate leading into London, where he's sort of enmeshed in the comings and goings of everyone. And in 1374, same year, he becomes, this is going to be the most exciting part of the lecture tonight, he becomes the controller of customs on wool. And in case you're not duly shocked, controller of customs on wool means he is in charge of all the import and export taxes associated with the wool trade. The wool trade is the single most important source of revenue for the crown in Chaucer's lifetime. England is famous for wool, so getting Getting given responsibility for all of this means he is one of the most useful and most important functionaries of the royal crown. This is all super interesting because for the last 25 years of the 14th century, what happens with the English crown is we descend into pure chaos. Edward III dies in 1377, at which point his grandson, Richard II, becomes king. There's a really charming story. At the coronation, Richard falls asleep. His uncle has to carry him from the coronation, asleep in his arms, his sandals falling off his foot. It's really sweet. Until you stop to think about what it means to have a 10-year-old boy as king. The Vulgate tells you, woe to the land where the child is king. And the English will have time and time and time again to reflect on this proverb over the next 15 years. Because here's what happens. You have a 10-year-old boy as a king. His more powerful uncles are just sort of a little bit on the outskirts, right? His father died before his grandfather. So by primogeniture, the throne comes to him. And England needs, at this point, an experienced hand. The Hundred Years' War is still going on. English society is changing due to the Black Death, depopulating the country and massively sort of shaking up the labor market. And you've got a kid on the throne. The first bit of chaos is 1381, the peasants' revolt. Peasants are angry about taxation. Peasants are angry about just general maltreatment. They march on London, determined to purge the country of the sort of what they view as the leeches on it. And this means particularly the bureaucracy. They execute Simon Sudbury, Archbishop of Canterbury and Chancellor of England, one of the most powerful men in England, the primate of all England, gets executed by these peasants. Eventually, the rebellion's put down, but the whole world is shaken up. 1388, Richard has proved to be a really bad king. Some of the most powerful lords of the kingdom, called the Lords Appellant, gain control of Parliament. They execute a number of the king's favorites, including three men who were Chaucer's essentially co-workers and colleagues. Chaucer himself escapes. The next decade, Richard regains power, he abuses power, and finally, climactically, his cousin, Henry Bolingbroke, marches back on England from exile, reclaims his ancestral lands, deposes Richard, and becomes Henry IV. If you don't know the story, Shakespeare gives you a fairly colorful, largely fictional version of it. In Richard II. Chaucer himself dies a year after Henry IV comes to the throne. And it's against this backdrop, rebellion, sort of political intrigue, as a member of the political class himself, that he writes this great work, The Canterbury Tales, which is meant to survey and meant to sort of document everything that's going on in English life in its day. So that's the background. I've talked more than I intended about the background. Now, I would really very much like to talk about the poetry. So we're going to turn to the general prologue, and I promise you I'm not going to take 100 minutes, although I think the right time to spend on it is about 3 hours. I think that's the actual right time for the general prologue. But here's my goal for the next 20 minutes or so. First of all, I want you to see how and why Chaucer really is the father of English poetry. I'd like to get you some sense about how to read the prologue, and getting a sense of how to read the prologue and Chaucer's characters will give you a sense of how to approach the poem itself, the larger poem. So, with that in mind, let's turn to the first 18 lines. I'm not going to follow up on Annie's threat to make anyone read Middle English, except for myself. So, if you've got your books, we are on page 14, I'm going to read the first 18 lines in Middle English. If you want to read the 18 lines in Modern English, you absolutely can. If you want to follow along in the Middle English, you can. All right? But here comes the most famous opening line in all of medieval English poetry. Juan that April, with his shure sota, the drugt of March hath persed to the rota, and badded every vine in switch liqueur of which vertue engendered is the fleur. Juan Zephyr's ache with his sway to breath, and spirit hath in every holt and heath, the tender acropis and the younger sona hath in the ram his half course irona. And smaller fool is machen melodia that sleepen all the nicht with open ear. So pricketh hem natur in her courages, than longen folk to go on pilgrimages, and palmers for forsaken strange strandes to fairer hallways, couth in sundry landes, and specially from every shearer's ender of Engoland to Canterbury they wender, the howly blissful martyr for forsaken, that hem hath holpen when that they were saken. I will not be doing Middle English much more. I really won't. In the interest of time, I won't do it. If you want to learn to read Chaucer's Middle English, if you slog through for about 6 weeks to 2 months, if you slog through every day for 6 weeks to 2 months, you'll start to recognize it and hear it, and it gets much easier after that. Students who begin in January have a pretty good command of it by March or April if they stick with it. But to the poetry itself, there are so many things we can talk about here, so many things that are wonderful and new and exciting. One is, allow me to be an English professor for a second, we've got iambic pentameter. And that's so exciting because Chaucer is the one who makes iambic pentameter a thing in English poetry. Before that, you have octosyllabic couplets, which don't really work in English, or you've got old alliterative lines that don't make the jump to the modern world. The iambic pentameter tradition, which Shakespeare, in which Milton, in which Alexander Pope write in, begins with Geoffrey Chaucer. That's really, really cool. He's also just an exemplary poet. He's so good at writing. And this means he doesn't just write good ideas. He wraps them in the perfect language. Look at lines 5 and 6 again, if you would. All right. Now, the Bidler translation says, when also Zephyrus with his sweet breath has breathed spirit into the tender new shoots in every wood and meadow. And that's all right. But what Chaucer actually wrote was this. When Zephyrus ake with his sweeter breath, in spirit hath in every holt and heath the tender acropus. That's what he wrote. And that line 6 is so fantastic. In spirit hath in every holt and heath. It's literally breathed spirit into, it's breathed breath into every woodland and every meadow. But listen to the sounds, right? You've got all the H's in spirit, hath, holt, heth. You've got the long vowels. And the result is you've got a line that sounds like the breeze sighing through the trees in April, right? It's the sound of that just sort of sweet, sweet sound of leaves rustling in the trees. And Chaucer will do this all the time. When he has a battle scene, the battle scene will crash and it'll be loud and it'll be sort of fractious, right? When he wants to write smoothly, he can write smoothly. When he wants to write really embarrassingly bad poetry for some of his characters, he'll write really embarrassingly bad poetry because he's that kind of poet. We won't get a lot of this in the translation, but it's important to me that you at least see it. And the sweetness of that line ties into what's going on in these first 18 lines too. It's April. It's Easter season. The whole natural world, the trees and the birds, they're springing back to life after the long cold winter and the drought of March. The idea of the drought of March also ties back into Lent because April is new life. It's Easter when you have the holy water flowing and when the life has come back into the church as well. And the characters, they were sick, they were ill. And now, having been healed of their diseases and delivered from winter, they are inspired to go off on pilgrimage to seek the blissful martyr, Thomas of Canterbury, and to give thanksgiving for it. This is the opening 18 lines of the general prologue. It's spiritual renewal, it's natural renewal, it's social renewal, and it's so perfect. It's also about as simple as we get for Chaucer. Things are going to get incredibly complicated, so it's important that we keep this joyful beginning in mind. Because what we learn is Chaucer himself has gone on pilgrimage, right? So it happened on a day that I was at the inn, the Tabard in Southwark, and 29 people came into the inn. And now this is a blink and you miss it thing, so please pay attention here. 29 people come into the inn. Chaucer writes himself into his own poem as a character. And what does Chaucer do? Well, he finds out there are 29 other pilgrims. Line 30, and shortly, when the sun had gone down, I had spoken with every one of them, so that I soon had become one of their group, and we made an arrangement to rise early. It's the evening time. He's at the inn before the sun has set. The man has gone around to 29 strangers, introduced himself, spoken to each one of them, and now he's going to tell you his story and theirs. This is important. I am an introvert. If I am sitting in a coffee shop and a stranger comes in, as I was this afternoon, I'm more likely to sort of huddle a little bit closer with my book and hope not to make eye contact to avoid another person bothering me. Chaucer sees 29 strangers come in, and he comes up. Hi, I'm Jeff. Let's talk. And he goes around and speaks to every one of them. He's that sort of person. He's the sort of person who likes people a lot. And not only that, line 36, before I pass further on in this tale, it seems to me in order to tell you all about each of them, as they seemed to me, and who they were, and of what rank in life, and also what they wore. So, when he tells you what all these pilgrims are, this is not an omniscient narrator giving you God's eye view of who these people are. This is an extreme extrovert who loves talking to people, saying, hey, I talked to all these cool people. Let me tell you all about them. So what we're getting is what they told Chaucer combined with his own observations. This may or may not be true in every case. It may or may not be accurate in every case. And that's where a lot of the fun lies. So I've been talking very quickly. We'll slow down now. All right. Obviously, we don't have time to deal with every possible character in the general prologue. But just to get a sense of how the general prologue works, we'll take one example that's clearly good, one example that's clearly bad, and one example that shows how Chaucer's ambiguity tends to work. So the good one, one of the few good ones, is the knight. You'll meet him on page 17, about line 43. So if you've got our books, there was a knight, a valiant man, who from the time when he had first begun to venture out, he loved chivalry, truth, and honor, liberality, generosity, and courtesy. He had proved his worth in his lord's wars, in which he had ridden as far as any man, both in Christendom and in the heathen lands, and he had always been honored for his valor. So the first thing we learn is he is the perfect knight. He loves chivalry. He loves truth, which is both sort of truth in word, but truth in deed and truth in character. He is completely honorable, completely noble. He's been to an astonishing number of places. He's been all over Europe and the Mediterranean fighting on crusade. But even though he's the guy who wins every fight he's in, if you go to page 19, line 68, though he was valiant, he was prudent, and he bore himself as meekly as a maiden. Never in all his life had he been rude to anyone at all. He was a true, perfect, gentle knight, but to tell you about his array, his horses were good, but he was not gaily dressed. He wore a fustian tunic. A fustian is a rough cloth, much stained by his hauberk, his mail coat, for he had just come back from his expedition and was on his way to make pilgrimage. So the picture of this guy is someone who is the most fearsome guy on the battlefield, but off the battlefield, he is as gentle and polite and quiet and sweet as anyone you've ever met. He's the exemplar of chivalry, which C.S. Lewis calls the special contribution of the Middle Ages to our culture, uniting both heroic valor and courteous meekness. He's so pious that he has just gotten home from his military expedition. He's taken off his mail coat. He hasn't even changed clothes before he's on the road to Canterbury to go pray to St. Thomas. The knight is pretty much perfect. The only person who doesn't think he's perfect is Terry Jones, who is one of the Monty Python guys who thinks he's a mercenary. Terry Jones and Monty Python are wrong on this. The knight is practically perfect in every way. So that one's easy. Let's go to another incredibly easy one. Let's do the summoner. The summoner is fun. So if we go to page 49, this is towards the end of the general prologue. 49, line 625. Now, as you're finding the passage, I'll tell you, a summoner, you can be served summons by a clerk of court or by a lawyer today, right? You've been served. The summoner does this for ecclesiastical courts because you can be fined for violating all sorts of precepts of the church. If you've been skipping mass on Sundays, if you've been living in sin out of wedlock, there are all sorts of ways that you can be summoned. The summoner is the guy who goes out and gives summons. Obviously, this is prone to abuse, and this summoner does it. Line 625. A summoner was with us there who had a fire red face like a cherub in a painting. For the record, sometimes my students think that the comparison to a cherub means he's innocent. No, it means he's terrifying. His face is literally bright red. He was pimply with narrow eyes. He was hot and lecherous as a sparrow with scabby black brows and a scanty beard. His face frightened little children. Tell us what you really think, Jeffrey, right? This guy is odious in every possible way. We learn that no medicine will clear the pimples from his face. We learn that he eats a diet of garlic, leeks, and onions, so he just reeks. And he's morally reprehensible. He takes bribes. He lets people slip out from their ecclesiastical duties. If you give him a quart of wine, he'll let you have your concubine for a year. He himself visits prostitutes often. He tells people that you don't have to worry about excommunication unless your hell is your wallet. Your wallet is the archdeacon's hell, said he at line 660. Line 661 is weird. But I know well that he lied indeed, for every guilty man should dread excommunication. For excommunication will slay just as absolution saves. Here Chaucer, our extroverted people person, says, now wait a minute. This is a step too far. That guy is a stinking liar. Excommunication is a really serious deal. You should take it really seriously. All right? So the summoner is a wholly negative portrait. Let's turn to an ambiguous one. This is not my favorite ambiguous portrait, but it's one of the easiest ones to get a sense of. This is the monk. The monk you meet on page 23, 165, line 165. I'm going to pause for just a second as you find your passage. I would also pause and invite you to think about what you remember about the monk if you had a chance to read it, okay? And as you're thinking about this, the monk is going to be, in many ways, a picture of clerical corruption. But it's a really interesting thing the way he's a picture of clerical corruption. So here we go. There was a monk, a splendid sort, an inspector of his monastery's estates, who loved venery, that's hunting, a manly man, capable of being an abbot. He had many a dainty horse in the stable, and when he rode, one might hear the bells on his bridle jingle in the wind as loud and clear as the chapel bell in the place where this monk was in charge. As for the rule of St. Maurus or St. Benedict, since it was old and somewhat strict, this same monk let old-fashioned things pass away and held to the ways of the modern world. Next page. He didn't give a plucked hen for that text, which says that hunters are not holy men, and that a monk, when he's heedless of his duty, is like a fish out of water. That is to say, a monk out of his cloister. But he held that text was not worth an oyster. Now, when I teach this in class, my students always and inevitably hate the monk. And they point out all the things you're probably thinking right now. He's hewing to the world rather than to the rule. He's obviously not following poverty, chastity, and obedience, right? He's strong. He's fat. He's not fasting. The end of his portrait says he's not pale as a ghost that's pined away. He loves a roast swan more than any other roast flesh. If you know the rule of St. Benedict, you know St. Benedict's attitude towards eating any meat, let alone something as luxurious as roast swan. This is a really crummy monk. But there's something that's terrifying in the monk's portrait. I stopped at line 182. He held that text was not worth an oyster. He says, forget that text. And I said, Chaucer, his opinion was good. Why should he study and drive himself mad, always poring over a book in the cloister, or work with his hands in labor as St. Augustine ordered? How shall the world be served? Chaucer says or appears to say that this guy is on the level. This guy gets it. So what are we supposed to do with this? We don't have a lot of time to dive into it, but I'll just go quickly here. We have to remember that Chaucer is the people person, and Chaucer is presenting these people as they presented themselves. Now, we have to imagine what the monk would have told him. It would be something like, yes, I'm the outrider for the monastery. It's my job to inspect the monastery's estates. We have a lot of land. It takes a lot of time riding around. In my job, I have to deal with the local lords. I have to deal with the local gentry, and they like hunting. So I like hunting too, because I'm not good at studying. I'm not good at manual labor, but I'm good at talking to people. I'm good at raising money. I'm good at doing these things. How shall I serve the world? I serve the world like this. Other people serve it by poverty, chastity, and obedience. And this, guys, is Chaucer's genius in the general prologue. We're in a chaotic world. We're in a world that's threatening to come apart at the seams. And he gives you this cross-section of society, right? It's a social cross-section. You go from the knight, who's quite high-ranking, to a peasant plowman. It's also a moral cross-section. You've got the parson, who's a living saint, all the way to the pardoner, who abuses the church's power of mercy to make profit for himself. And with each one of these people, he's going to let them speak in their own voice. With each one of these people, he's going to let them tell their own story. That's daring enough. It gets better when we go to the tale-telling game. As they're preparing to leave, the innkeeper says, you know, the road to Canterbury can get kind of boring, so I propose a game. On the way there, everybody tells two tales. On the way back, everybody tells two tales. And whoever tells the story that is has the most sentence, that is the best sort of moral, and the most solas, which is the most entertainment value, will get a free dinner. So all the pilgrims, not all, many of the pilgrims, are going to tell their stories. Chaucer says at the end of the general prologue, I have to tell you what they said. I have to be honest. And so, who said the Catholic Church's motto should be, here comes everybody? Here comes everybody. The holy and the good and the wise and the foolish, and they're all going to speak. Now, the nice thing is, we get to start with the knight. By luck or chance or providence, the knight, the best guy, draws the short straw, and it's his job to tell his tale first. And that's what we're going to be spending, as I look at my clock, probably most of the rest of our time on, if not all the rest of our time. All right, Knight's Tale. The Knight's Tale is Chaucer's longest tale. It's one of his most ambitious tales. It's well over 2,000 lines long, so if you would take this out, it could be a text that you study just on its own. In the interest of time, I'm going to give the 5-minute executive summary. All right? The Knight's Tale is a romance, which means it's a tale of chivalry and love. All right? We begin with Theseus, the classical Theseus, the king of Athens, who has become, in this telling, the Duke of Athens, with the typical medieval attitude towards anachronism, which means we don't care about anachronism. Theseus is now a duke and a knight. All right? In fact, he's an awful lot like the knight himself. He loves chivalry, truth, honor, conquest. He conquers the Amazons at the beginning of the story. He comes back home. He finds some petitioners, some women whose husbands have been killed and their corpses desecrated in Thebes. So he goes off and he conquers Thebes. As Theseus is coming back from Thebes, he takes two prisoners from the battlefield, Arsita and Palamon. These are cousins of the Theban royal house, and Theseus decides he's going to keep them in prison perpetually, basically as hostages. Arsita and Palamon are the real focus of the story. The inciting action is one morning in May, Palamon looks out the window. He sees Theseus's sister-in-law, the beautiful young Amalia, walking in a garden, and he says, oh my gosh, I'm in love with this woman, because you can absolutely fall in love at first sight in the Middle Ages, and nobody thinks about this, okay? I am passionately in love. Oh, maybe she's a goddess, and then he prays to her because he thinks she might be Venus. Arsita comes, says, hey, bro, what's wrong? And he looks out the window, and he says, oh my gosh, That's the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. I am passionately in love. And then Palamon says, I saw her first. And then Arcita says, you didn't even know she was a mortal woman. And also, all's fair in love and war, so who cares about whatever promise I might have made to never get in your way with a girl? I'm going after her too. Obviously, nothing can happen because these guys are in prison and nobody talks to them. But as chance has it, Arcita has a powerful friend who is Theseus's best friend. He is released from prison, but exiled from Athens. So he goes back home to Thebes. Palamon sits in prison and just waits. Again, the Middle Ages have odd ideas about love. One of their ideas is if you are deprived of the object of your love, you can fall into the lover's malady and waste away. You'll absolutely waste away physically. Arcita does for a whole year until he's so transformed in appearance, no one will recognize him. He comes back to Athens. He works his way up through the ranks of Theseus's household and eventually becomes Theseus's right-hand man and gets to see Amalia every day. Meanwhile, Palamon escapes prison, is going to go get an army at Thebes, and he's going to win Amalia by conquest or die trying. As fate would have it, the two cousins meet in the woods. They decide they're going to fight to the death for the girl. As they're fighting to the death, Theseus, coincidence of coincidences, comes up, says, wait a minute, what's going on here? He learns, and after threatening to kill them, decides it would be way cooler to have this massive tournament to see who gets the girl. It's going to be the most romantic, most chivalric event in the history of the world. So these two guys go, they gather their armies, they come back, they fight. Arcita wins. He wins the battle, but there's an earthquake, a supernatural appearance. His horse bucks him off. His chest gets crushed. He dies in agony. His last words are, mercy, Emily. We burn him, have a huge funeral. Everyone weeps, and then some years pass, and Theseus says, hey, why don't Amalia and Palamon get married? We have one girl and one guy. Let's get them married. The end. They live happily ever after. That's the story in 5 minutes. Now, the plot, though, it's interesting if you like medieval romance. It's hardly the most important thing of The Knight's Tale. The most important thing of The Knight's Tale is this. It's the theme. It's the philosophy. And it's the attempt to reconcile all of these sort of primal questions of human existence. Questions like, how can you make order in a chaotic world? How do human fortune and divine providence work together? How can God be just when bad things happen to good people? And in exploring these questions, Chaucer isn't just striking out on his own. Shortly before he writes The Knight's Tale, he had translated, I should have it on my bookshelf here. Can't find it at this moment. He had translated Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy, which is absolutely one of the greatest books of the Western tradition. You should all read Boethius's Consolation of Philosophy. And he takes these questions from Boethius and he works them into the fabric of The Knight's Tale. Once you know this, everything starts to make sense. So just to take some very quick hit kind of examples. When Theseus comes riding back to Athens, having conquered the Amazons, by the way, Athens conquering Amazons is order winning over chaos. That's what it always means because Athens is rationality, reason, discipline. Amazons are chaos and passion. Order has won. He comes back. He finds that order hasn't won because he's got these weeping queens waiting for him. The eldest of them, on page 75, line 55, gives a speech that has Boethius written all over it. Listen carefully here. My lord, to whom fortune has given victory in the life due to a conqueror, your glory and honor do not grieve us at all. Rather, we beg for mercy and aid. She goes on, there's not one of us all, line 64, who has not been a duchess or a queen. Now we are wretches, as is evident, thanks to fortune and her false wheel, her who assures happiness to no condition of men. Fortune's wheel, guys. The wheel of fortune, the game show is named because of this. The wheel of fortune is this. Fortune's at her spinning wheel. She's always turning the wheel. The person who's on top of the wheel right now is going to be cast down and crushed under it later. If you're crushed under the wheel right now, you'll be lifted up soon, because fortune always changes. So how do you live when you can't be assured of earthly happiness because fortune changes? When you look at Arsita and Palamon, you'll get some of the answers. When Arsita gets exiled from prison, he gives one of the very greatest philosophical speeches in literature. You can come to page 93, line 393. Arsita is depressed because, exiled from prison, he can no longer see Amalia. Seeing Amalia is the only thing that matters, and now, even though he's free, he can't see her anymore. He says, "Alas, why do people so commonly complain over God's providence or over fortune, which often gives them in many a fashion something much better than they themselves can devise? One man desires to have wealth, which becomes the cause of his being murdered or greatly diseased. Another man would willingly get out of his prison, who in his home will be slain by one of his household. There are infinite evils under this heading. We do not know what we pray for in this connection." That's a horrible translation. "We don't know what we pray for here on earth," is a better translation. "We are like the man who is drunk as a mouse. A drunken man knows he has a house, but he doesn't know the right way there. And to the drunk man, every path is slippery." He says, we're all seeking happiness. We all want happiness, but we don't even know what to pray for. Like the drunkard who knows he has home, but doesn't know the path because every path is making him fall down. That's us seeking our happiness. Now, for Boethius, happiness means you seek God, where all stability is. For Arsita, happiness means I really, really, really want that girl. But we're still following the same general question. Palamon, as he's sitting in prison, can't do anything about his fate, says, I'm not going to grab the passage, but what governance is in this prescience that guiltless tormenteth innocence? What possible reason, rationality, governance? What reason, governance, order can there be in God's providence when the guiltless are tormented, completely innocent? How can God be good? How can God's providence be good when good people suffer without deserving it? And these are the questions that the Knight's Tale is very keen on answering. You see it the night before the tournament when Arsita illustrates his principle. We don't know what we ask for here. Before the tournament, the two cousins go to two different temples to pray to their gods, right? Palamon makes the good prayer. He goes to Venus, the goddess of love, and says, give me Emily. I don't care about anything else. I want the girl. He's fixed on her. Arsita goes to the temple of Mars, the god of war. He says, I know I can't get Emily without winning the battle, so I ask to win the battle and nothing else. And this is how Arsita wins the battle, but Palamon gets the girl. They both get what they ask for because we don't know what we ask for here. And with all this tension and all this anxiety, with Arsita dying and everyone weeping, Theseus, our symbol of order, the knight's own mouthpiece, is going to give us a grand conclusion to try to tie everything together. This is the very, very famous fair chain of love speech at the end of the Knight's Tale. It begins at line 2129 on page 187, and it really continues, honestly, to about 2230. It's a 100-line speech to wrap all these concerns up. And this is going to be basically where we end tonight. When the first mover of the supernal cause first made the fair chain of love, great was the outcome. His plan was exalted. He well knew why and what he intended by it. For with that fair chain of love, he bound the fire, the air, the water, and the earth within sure limits so that they might not flee. The same prince and mover has established down in this wretched world certain periods and durations for all that's engendered here, beyond which limits they may not pass, although they may well shorten their days. We go a little bit further. That mover is immovable and eternal. Anyone but a fool may easily see that every part derives from the whole to which it belongs. For nature did not take its beginning from a mere part or portion of a thing, but from a thing that is complete and unchangeable, descending until the point where it's subject to destruction. And therefore, in his wise providence, he has beyond doubt so well arranged his scheme that particular things and happenings are to last by succeeding themselves, but not by being individually eternal. So he says, hey, the oak tree lives a long time, but then it dies. The stone lasts a long time, but then it breaks, because eventually God calls everything back to itself. Line 2179, he converts everything into its proper source from which it was derived. Against this, no living creature can strive. Here's the big consolation. The first mover, or God, lets down from heaven this chain of love. Things descend from God, or they emanate from God if you're a Platonist, or they're created by God if you're a Christian. But they go out from God, that's the exitus. They come back to God, that's the reditus. God sends them out, and then he calls them home. You can't fight it. That's really good. But here's the funny thing. If you know that fortune always changes, and if you know that God ultimately calls himself back to you, you can probably guess what the proper philosophical answer to all these problems is. The answer is, you raise your eyes up, you follow the path back home, you look to God, because that's where you're going to find stability. Our hearts are restless until they rest in you. Theseus doesn't do that. He gives this great speech, and then he says, then it is wisdom, it seems to me, to make virtue of necessity. He says, and therefore the moral of the story is, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Palamon, you're sad. Emily, you're sad. Why don't you two crazy kids get married? They get married, and they're happy. And it seems like we've just entered the world of fortune again, doesn't it? We haven't actually solved anything. We haven't done what Boethius would have you do, which is look up to God because you'll find happiness there. We've come back down to earth. Then, if you think a little bit more closely, there are all these little warning signs. Theseus is a pagan. He says Jupiter causes everything. In reality, in the story, Saturn, the bad god, causes everything. That's weird. If you read the 20 lines before this, I don't know if any of you caught this, there's a reason why Theseus gives his cool philosophical speech. The Athenians have decided it's time to bring Thebes under their thumb once and for all. Theseus thinks it's a great idea to have a sort of lackey rule in Thebes. So he's going to make Palamon marry his sister-in-law, which he wants to do anyway, and now Palamon will be a very loyal lackey forever. The Knight's Tale is noble, and it's beautiful, and it's great. But the funny thing about it is it doesn't actually finally answer all the questions. It doesn't finally resolve all the issues. It leaves these things hanging, and it leaves them hanging because the pilgrimage isn't over. We've got more stories to tell. We've got more voices to hear, and we've got further investigations into these problems to see. We're going to sum up this way because it'll be helpful for your future reading, all right? When the Knight's Tale is done, everyone says, oh my gosh, what a fantastic story that was. When the knight had told his tale, this is page 203. In all that company, there was no one, young or old, who didn't say it's a noble story. The host is thrilled. He turns to the monk, who is a really impressive guy, and says, now, sir monk, if you can, tell something to match the knight's tale. The Middle English word for match is quita, and it's one of the single most important words in all the Canterbury Tales. So let me be a dork and talk about this word for 30 seconds. Quit is the root of the modern word requite. It can mean match. It can mean pay back. It can mean get even. Okay, all these things are meant by the word quita. So the host says, hey, monk, it's time for you to do something that will get you on the knight's level. Match him. The monk doesn't get to talk. The miller, who is one of the more colorful and rascally characters from the general prologue, he's already drunk. He cries out in a loud voice and says, I'm going to tell a story. And I will tell you a story to quita the knight's tale, to match, get even, repay. The miller's tale is a tale we will not be discussing in detail with the ICC. The genre of it is fablio, which is a dirty story, usually a dirty story that involves, well, this one involves adultery, fart jokes, and things that are less savory than that. But the Miller's Tale is meant to match the Knight's Tale. How is this? It focuses on an old carpenter who has married a young wife, this young, beautiful wife. She is being courted by two rival suitors. One gets the girl, the other one gets horribly embarrassed. And when you see the pattern, it's like, oh my gosh, it's the Knight's Tale, but it's dragged from the level of noble, chivalric, philosophical romance to a dirty tavern story. Theseus becomes the carpenter. Amalia becomes this promiscuous young wife. The noble knights become two clerics who are trying to sleep with the wife. And that's what the miller does to match the Knight's Tale. When the miller's done with his tale, the reeve gets furious. And he says he's going to tell a story to Quita, the miller's tale. The reeve then does this because he himself is a carpenter. When the miller tells a tale about a carpenter who gets cuckolded, the reeve takes offense at this. He's like, you're talking about me. I'm an old carpenter. I'll get back at you. So he tells a story about a really stupid, ugly, ape-like miller whose wife and daughter get seduced / raped by two young students. And that's the reeve's tale. He's given his voice. He has paid back, gotten even with the miller. And then from this, the miller story is dirty. C.S. Lewis says it's funny. It is funny, but it's a dirty story. That's sort of like, haha, that was funny and I feel bad at laughing at it. Nobody laughs at the reeve's tale. It's just a nasty revenge story. We look back at the Knight's Tale and we're like, where did this come from? And the answer is, it comes from the pilgrimage. Because each tale is responding to the other tales. Each teller is trying to answer or respond to the things that have come before. And if you want to get the meaning of the Canterbury Tales, it's this. Everyone in this chaotic world is given their chance to tell their story. Everyone in the chaotic world is given a chance to respond to the other people's stories. So the Knight's Tale doesn't have its complete meaning alone. The Knight's Tale is beautiful and noble, but then you've got to ask, what does it mean to have a beautiful, noble story that immediately gets parodied and immediately descends here? And when you move forward into the next readings for the Canterbury Tales, you're going to be going into a series of stories about marriage. And they're all trying to answer themselves about how marriage ought to work. So that's what I have for tonight. I've got some time. I think we've got time for question and answers.
I'm stunned by that summation, Dr. Reinhardt. I can't wait until next time to see how this goes. Whew, I'm sweating too. Thank you so much. This was a really great start to what I think is going to be a fun couple of evenings going through the Canterbury Tales. I was wondering how you were going to do the Miller's Tale and the Reeve's Tale. It was very, very subtle. Good. Nicely done.
You know, in my undergrad, I was taught the Miller's Tale by a nun, a sweet and holy nun. She had us, as our final project, do a live reading of the tales, and my classmates, being degenerates, said, let's do the Miller's Tale. I got to be the narrator. So, you know, again, if sister can handle it, most of us can probably handle it, but it's a bit of a thing.
Yeah, I was going to say, how should we read stuff like that as Catholics? Like, it's hard to not feel scandalized by it when we're reading it, right? So how do you kind of like navigate that? I don't want to sound like a prude or anything, but at the same time, it is kind of like you're reading smutty novels almost.
So I think the first thing I would say is, there's a difference between vulgarity and sensuality. Chaucer will be vulgar. He's basically never sensual, right? Now, vulgarity, I'm not saying take vulgarity completely lightly, but I've never met a student who is seriously tempted to transgress a commandment or seriously tempted to lust or impurity or anything like that by Chaucer. So I think we would sort of set that off on the one hand. The other thing is, I think it's G.K. Chesterton says that it's Chaucer who writes the first true English novel, where he's just presenting the world as it is. And part of the world is sin. Chaucer's not going to be shy about giving you sin. And sometimes I think he takes some pleasure in writing it. I don't think it'd be possible for the man to have written The Miller's Tale without a smile on his face. But he also knows where The Miller's Tale is going to go into The Reeve's Tale. So I think he's got those cautions there. That makes sense.
Sure. Sure. Thank you. So as we move into Q&A, Dr. Reinhardt, there's a question just asking about the bad and the ambiguous characters. So they're bad or they're ambiguous, but they're also making a pilgrimage, right? So are we able to judge their motivations? Are they pure motivations that they're making the pilgrimage?
So all you're told very clearly is people go to seek the holy, blissful martyr who helped them when they were sick. Pilgrimage is actually a very controversial topic in Chaucer's England. Simon Sudbury, the Archbishop of Canterbury, who I mentioned before, he critiques pilgrimages because he says that they're being abused. They're just sort of pleasure trips. They're not actually pious. They're being degraded. The Lollards, the heretical group of the Lollards, will make largely the same arguments. So very much, we don't know what their motives are. But the important thing is they are on the pilgrimage, right? They're on this pilgrimage, which should be an occasion of grace. And that's one of the beautiful things about the world that Chaucer lives in. There's very little that would unite people of these highly disparate characters, highly disparate, different moralities and priorities in a common purpose together today. But pilgrimage unites them then. So the good and the mixed and even the bad have that orientation in their lives. And I think that's a profound witness of the beauty of Chaucer's world and kind of a sobering thing to think about for us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Sort of all of our need for grace, right? I mean, it becomes even more clear with these knaves that are on the pilgrimage and telling these tales. Gordon here on screen, why don't you go ahead with your question?
Thank you. Dr. Reinhardt, my question has to do with the sexual elements, what they call the ribald parts, if I remember from college, they call them, of Chaucer's. Would they have been as scandalous in their society as a couple sharing the same bed in the 1950s on TV in our society?
Oh, boy. So the short answer is I don't know, partially because I don't know the scandal of the 1950s.
I love Lucy.
Yeah. I think the thing I would say is there is anxiety in Chaucer's world about tales like this, right? Chaucer himself expresses anxiety when he tells the Miller's Tale. He says, you know, the Miller's a churl. You know, he's a bad guy. So if you don't like it, you can just turn the page over. Now, is this just sort of covering his back or is he sincere? Chaucer is the master of ambiguity, so you're not going to get that completely. There's also the very puzzling text known as Chaucer's Retraction, composed probably towards the end of his life, where he says, I'm sorry for all those tales of Canterbury that sunen unto sinna, that sort of relate sin. So it's a very, very complicated question. I suppose in his own lifetime, there was no censoring of it, right? There wasn't that deep anxiety, although other people in the tale will be anxious about the tales themselves. So people of good conscience or of delicate conscience will object. A lot of people won't. And that's about the best we can do.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Dick, go ahead with your question.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Very good. Enjoyed the lecture, Dr. Reinhardt. The question is, what was Chaucer's strategy in ordering the tales in the order that he did?
That is a massively, massively complex question. There are actually arguments about what order the tales should go into. And because the work's not complete, it's a little bit tricky to know exactly how things should work. Here's the 30-second version. it does seem that the order that most editions give you, which is the order drawn from the Ellesmere manuscript, is the one that Chaucer wants. And if we just look at the first set of tales, I think it's pretty clear why he does the way he does things the way he does. General prologue leads naturally to knight. We start off with the highest member of the pilgrimage, the most noble, and that is fitting. Then the chaos intrudes, because I think Chaucer wants life to be more chaotic than that. There are other literary works that are like the Canterbury Tales in that they have tale tellers telling their stories. Boccaccio's Decameron does this, but nobody else does what Chaucer does, where he has everybody speaking. And so the idea that we disrupt the hierarchy so that this frankly gross commoner, the miller, can speak is part of the point, because the world isn't just the noble philosophical romance, it's also the gross fabliau, right? Then you descend to the Reeve. The Reeve's tale prompts the cook, who is one of the nastiest characters, to try to tell a tale, but it just breaks off mid-tale, and then Chaucer starts fresh again. When we move to later tales, there's a pretty clear sequence of discussions on marriage that he goes through. The last tales are all meant to reflect in some way on the nature of poetry, the nature of Chaucer's vocation as a poet, and the true meaning of a pilgrimage. So there is sort of this beginning, middle, and end. The ordering's not perfect, so some things kind of move around, but that's the bulk of the order that Chaucer is going to give you.
Okay, thank you very much.
There's a question from John, Dr. Reinhardt, asking if Chaucer is writing an allegory here. Apparently there's some debate among literary scholars about this.
So is Chaucer writing an allegory? Certainly not in the way that Langland is writing an allegory in Pierce Plowman. There are all sorts of debates as to what Chaucer is doing with the ordering of the tales. Some people think he's doing an allegory of learning derived from the planetary model of the Ptolemaic universe. Maybe so. Is the pilgrimage itself an allegory for the pilgrimage to the heavenly Jerusalem as the parson suggests in the final tale? I think there are elements that are pointing to more than literal, right? I think there are certainly elements in individual tales that are inviting you to go more than simply literal. I think we'd be really hard-pressed to find a consistent allegory where you're having mental states personified, if we want to take the sort of Lewisian definition of allegory. I don't think you'd find that particularly clearly in Chaucer.
Holly asks, does he have a target audience?
Yes. So the main audience for Chaucer is this literate London audience that he himself comes from, right? It's a small audience, but it's a pretty lively one. So he's thinking, when he's writing, he's got an eye towards future readers because he's clearly got the sense that great poets get remembered forever. So he's thinking about you distantly, but immediately he's thinking about people in his world who will catch these in-jokes. So he will do funny little side comments about other literary figures. Sometimes he'll praise them. Sometimes he'll sort of poke at them. He will absolutely do that. And so imagine somebody who's part of, again, a community of literate people the size of a small college. That's absolutely his primary audience. That's absolutely what he's thinking about mainly.
All right. Katarina wrote me her question, and she said, so you mentioned that some questions are posed in the Knight's Tale, mentioning that the questions are unanswered because the pilgrimage had just started. She wants to know, is that also why the story has a pagan rather than a Christian setting? It is interesting that he chose, you know, like pagan Athenian and Thebes and the gods as sort of the actors in this story.
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely. So, the pagan setting is a funny thing. Medieval authors will set all sorts of things in pagan antiquity because Greece and Rome give you great things to write about. The fall of Troy, the house of Theseus, the Aeneid, they love this stuff. At the same time, Chaucer is not dumb to the fact that these people are pagans. The single greatest work Chaucer ever wrote is called Troilus and Cressida, and it's a love story set in the Trojan War. And after thousands and thousands of lines telling this love story, he ends this way. I'll just translate. Lo here the cursed old rites of the pagans. Lo here what all their gods may avail. Lo here the wretched appetites of the world. Lo here the reward for all this labor of Jove, Apollo, Mars, and other such rascals. So, starting off with our very Christian knight telling a story that's in very, very pagan, in very, very pagan Athens, I think that's part of it. I think that's part of the reason why you don't get the resolution. When Arcita dies, it's like, well, who knows where his soul went? And we just sort of punt on that, which helps us resist the closure, or is resistant to closure, I think I would say. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think maybe we can close it with that, Dr. Reinhardt. Any final parting remarks as we move into part two with you?
So, again, I think the most important thing is to remember that the tales and the tellers go together, right? It's usually not purely random who Chaucer assigns a tale to. So when you read, pay attention to the sort of confessional elements in the tales. You might find it useful before you read The Merchant's Tale, The Wife of Bath's Tale, The Franklin's Tale, to revisit their portrait in the general prologue and see what they sort of seem to be showing about themselves there, and then see how the tale brings that to greater life. I would suggest that. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, we will look forward to the next time. And Dr. Reinhardt, would you mind closing us in prayer?
I sure will. Yeah. So we're going to end in prayer like Chaucer ended in prayer. So this is the end of the Troilus. I'm going to read it in modern English, and I'll close then reading it properly in Middle English. Thou one and two and three eternally alive, who reignest always in three and two and one, uncircumscribed, but who may circumscribe everything else, us from visible and invisible foes defend, and to thy mercy make us, Jesus, in thy mercy, worthy, for the love of your benign, kind mother and maiden. Amen. So here we go. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen. Thu on and two and three eterna oniva, that regnest I in three and two and un, uncircumscript and all may circumscriva, us from visibla and invisibla fon defenda, and to thy mercy evrechon so maca us Jesu, for thy mercy digna, for love of Maida and Moder thin benigna. Amen.
We hope you enjoyed this program from the Institute of Catholic Culture. Remember to download our app and share our online library with friends, co-workers, and family members. To learn more, get involved, and support the Institute's work, visit instituteofcatholicculture.org and visit us on social media.